Before I start, I want to thank my co-authors who are listed here, and also by way of disclosure to indicate that the research that I'll be presenting today was sponsored and funded by Merck. The study had three main objectives. The first was to look at, well, the overall objective is to try to understand who and when people discontinue taking medications for treating diabetes, in this case oral anti-diabetic agents. And within that context, we were specifically interested in identifying factors that were predictive of relatively short periods without medication, which we defined as 3 to 6 months, medium term, 7 to 11, and long term discontinuation of 12 or more months. And the focus, as the title indicates, is on Medicare beneficiaries, and Medicare beneficiaries specifically who are enrolled in the Part D program between 2006 and 2008. We were particularly interested in factors change over time. And if any of you are familiar with the literature on drug adherence, much of it, in fact most of it, is focused upon characteristics of individuals which either raise or lower their overall risk of discontinuance, but are static. They don't change over time. And even people that are at high risk, that have characteristics associated with very high risk of discontinuance, most of those people at any given point will actually be adherent. So we were looking at change factors that would be predictive of when individuals decided to not continue their medication, and then who among them decided not to. And then we were particularly interested in those factors, those dynamic factors that occurred in the several months immediately preceding a discontinuance. So understanding adherence is something that researchers have been involved in for literally decades. So this is well-trodden ground. And if anybody is familiar with this literature, I mean, there are literally hundreds of papers that have examined specifically poor adherence with oral hypoglycemic agents. And most of those focus on those static risk factors that I mentioned earlier. No study that we have found looked at patient characteristics to systematically distinguish those who are most likely to have short versus long periods with discontinuance. And very few studies have identified specific dynamic factors that are associated with patients that discontinue OHAs. Not to say that studies don't include some, but there's been no systematic effort to examine those. So this is our methods data and the study design. We used as our base data a 5% random sample of Medicare beneficiaries who were enrolled in Medicare Part D, also had Part A and Part B, and we had 3 years of capture from the January of 2006 through December of 2008. We looked at people who were taking OHAs enrolled in standalone prescription drug plans. These are the plans that are not connected with Medicare Advantage or managed care, and that was necessary because we needed claims data from not only the drug claims but also hospital and medical claims. We identified four cohorts of individuals from this data set who had 12 months of baseline observation before they discontinued if they were a discontinuer. And among those who had evidence of discontinuation, we divided them into three groups according to short, long, and, or short, medium, and long term. And then we finally had a comparator group of those who were continuing OHA users. And we identified the month in which a discontinuer stopped taking OHAs, as well as the duration of the period without taking the medication. And for our continuing user cohort, we identified a random month that assured at least 12 months of baseline before they continued using. In other words, everyone had an index month, including the continuing users. And these are the variables that we identified. Many of these are commonly used in studies looking at at adherence with anti-diabetic medications, age, sex, race. There's not a lot, actually, that you can find out about individual socio-demographic characteristics from these data sets. We took what we could get. The original reason for Medicare entitlement is either age 65 or older, or if younger, disability or ESRD. We were able to identify individuals who received low-income subsidy from Medicare. That's important. This is primarily, but not exclusively, people who were a dual Medicare-Medicaid eligible. And then we identified, based upon a risk measure, the RxHCC. This is a risk adjuster that CMS uses to pay Part D plans for treating Medicare beneficiaries with medications. So we use that as a risk adjuster. And then we had dynamic variables. So we're measured at the index month and in each of the prior 6 months. So we had six observations, monthly observations, for each of these variables for all four of the cohorts. We looked at drug use variables. These included insulin, use of ACE inhibitors or ARBs, and statins. And then among those who were using ACEs, ARBs, or statins, we identified the month, if there was one, which the individual discontinued use of those medications using the same measures that we did for OHAs. We had diabetes tests, complications, and comorbidities. We had no test results, so although we could identify when somebody had an A1C test, we wouldn't know what the result of that was, similar for fasting blood glucose test. And then we looked at diagnostic codes, A and B diagnostic codes, for uncontrolled diabetes, short and long-term diabetes complications, hypoglycemia, ESRD, and cancer. And I would note, these are factors, again, that are commonly used in studies of adherence, but instead of identifying people that had evidence of this, we were looking at events that were at the month level. So if you had hypoglycemia, for example, we only coded it if there was evidence of that and a claim in that particular month. And if you had it in several months, then we coded it several times. And then we also looked at Medicare use and spending. We thought these might be indicative of other factors that we couldn't identify readily from the above measures. These included hospital and SNF discharge. We know that things go wrong at transition points, so we hypothesized that these would be associated with discontinuance, emergency room visits, number of physician visits, number of different physicians, Part A, B, and D spending in the month, and then whether the individual was in that particular month entered the so-called donut hole, or if they entered the catastrophic coverage phase, which would be indicative of the total level of drug spending over time. The basic statistical analytic approach we took was a multinomial logit. In other words, we took all of our variables and we tried to predict whether, based upon those variables, an individual ended up in the cohort of short-term, medium-term, and long-term discontinuers, or whether the person is more likely to be a continuing user, which was our base category. And to bring the dynamic variables into this model actually posed a challenge to us. And so we decided to approach it by looking at the factors month by month. So we started out our first multinomial regression model, included all of the static factors, and included monthly observations for each of the dynamic variables observed in the index month. That's the month in which they either discontinued or continued using. And then we replicated that using values for dynamic variables in the month before discontinuation, the second month before prior to discontinuation, the third, the fourth, and the fifth month. So we actually had six sets of results that we evaluated. Here are the characteristics of the population. We started out with 54,000 people who met all of the inclusion criteria. 83% of those, or 45,452, were continuing users, and you can see the ends for each of the discontinuer groups. The short-term and the long-term had roughly equal numbers, about 4,000 in each. The middle group, 7 to 11 months, had the lowest, 1,205 members in that cohort. I have to tell you that these distinctions in terms of short, medium, and long are actually quite arbitrary. We could change these around, although, as you'll see when we get into the results themselves, we don't think that that's going to have much of an impact on the implications of the findings. So how do continuing users differ from those who were discontinuers? Well, the age of continuing users fell right in the middle of the age of the discontinuers on average. Males, 33.9% of the continuing cohort, and that was higher, but only slightly higher than the proportion of males in the discontinuer cohorts. When you get to race, you see some big differences. 75% of continuers were white, whereas between 66 and 70% of the discontinuers were white. Low-income subsidy, one of the things that you might be surprised to learn is that a very high proportion of Medicare beneficiaries who have diabetes are receiving low-income subsidy. Meaning they're either, again, dual eligibles or have income just above that cutoff for dual eligibility. Almost 68% are receiving these subsidies. But those who discontinued, it was higher. In fact, reached almost 75% among those with long-term discontinuance. And in terms of RxHCC count, those who discontinued had higher comorbidity than those who continued using. And here are some descriptive characteristics for just the month of the month of the index, either discontinuation or continuation. This is not the whole list of variables by any manner of means, but it highlights some of the ones that I think were most important. So overall, among continuing users, 16% used insulin. We did not exclude insulin, and clearly insulin moving from an oral agent to insulin could be a reason for discontinuing oral agents, although the general practice is to add insulin rather than to replace an oral agent. 16% of those that continued had insulin, but for those that had long-term discontinuance of 12 months or more, over 40% were insulin users in the index month. I'm not going to show this in the results, but it's interesting nonetheless. We tracked individuals after 12 months for those that we could, and we found that individuals after 12 months, their insulin use actually dropped back to about 25%. So it wasn't that insulin use continued to go up, it actually dropped back. ACEs and ARBs, 62%. I mean, everybody should be taking these pretty much. And 62% of continuing users were lower percentages among the discontinuers were users of these agents. We were a little surprised by that, but it was consistent across the duration of analysis. And among those who were users among discontinuers, there was a higher rate of discontinuance. And we had expected that there'd be correlation of discontinuance across drug groups, but this showed it quite clearly. And among those who were long-term OHA discontinuers, we found that 6% had also discontinued, 7% had also continued ACE inhibitors or ARBs, and a similar pattern with statins. Hypoglycemia, as you know, is a relatively rare event in the context of actually generating a claim. Hypoglycemia is not rare at all, but generally it was not severe enough to generate a claim. And in our database, just 0.2% of continuing users had an episode of hypoglycemia that was claim-based, and that rose to about 2% for long-term discontinuers, again, in the month of discontinuation. And then you can see hospital discharge, SNF discharge, and ER visits. These are just very, very strongly correlated with discontinuance. The rates of these events are much, much higher, 10, 20-fold higher for those who discontinue. So here's the first of these are our multivariate results, and I know these are hard to spot. So let me see if I can explain. First of all, this group right here, these are the people who or short-term discontinuers. This is the 3 to 6 month group. This is the seven to 11 month group, and this is the 12 plus month group. What we're showing here are risk ratios of discontinuance by duration of discontinuance compared to continuing users. And I'll just use discontinuance with statins as my example here. So this is discontinuance of statins has in the month of discontinuation, the relative risk of discontinuation, if you discontinued a statin, was 11-fold over maintaining continuing use. And for ACEs and ARBs, discontinuation in that month was also highly elevated. And in the month prior to discontinuation, right here, the relative risk was still above 4. So this is a factor, these are factors that are highly correlated with long-term discontinuance. Now if you look here, you'll see that the same factors are also predictive of intermediate term discontinuance and even short-term discontinuance, but the predictive power is significantly lower. Insulin use, this is this blue bar here, this is insulin, this is insulin. Insulin elevates the risk of discontinuance with OHAs regardless of duration, but again, the relative risks are much, much higher for long-term discontinuance. And the two down here, the top red bar is ACEs and ARBs and statin. These are evidence of use in the month prior to discontinuation. And these things are just flat as pancakes, but they're strongly associated with discontinuance. The relative risks in these cases are between 0.6 and 0.75. So not taking statins and ACEs and ARBs is a persistent predictor of risk. And here are the hypoglycemic event results. Again, having hypoglycemia, the scale here is a little different, so these are not quite as big as the ones that we saw before. Having a hypoglycemic event is strongly predictive of long-term discontinuance. It's also strongly predictive of intermediate-term discontinuance, and actually much less predictive of short-term discontinuance. And having hypoglycemia in the month prior to the index month, right here and right here, is also elevates the chances that in the future the individual will discontinue use. And even in 2 months prior to the use of to the index month, right here, there's also an elevated risk. Before that, you see this big V shape in all three of these. That's really a statistical artifact because the numbers back here, the risk of hypoglycemia is just so low that it does not give us significant effects. The ESRD numbers are not going to surprise you. They are associated with fairly constant elevated risk of discontinuance. And this one gets a little messy, and I apologize for that. I'll just focus on these three. These were the ones that you saw in the descriptive statistics that were strongly associated with discontinuance, and that bears out here in terms of SNF discharge, hospital discharge, or an ER visit. Less so with intermediate, and not so much here in terms of short-term discontinuance with this medication class. So my conclusions are that different factors predict short, medium, and long-term discontinuance with OHAs. Actually, it's a different mix of factors as opposed to different factors and a difference in terms of the magnitude of the prediction of discontinuance. Overall, short-term discontinuance is harder to predict than longer-term discontinuance. And proximal dynamic factors explain a much higher proportion of the variance in terms of being a discontinuer than do static predictors. That's not going to surprise you. And the strongest predictors of medium and long-term OHA discontinuance were insulin use, ACEs, ARBs, statins. And by extension, we didn't do it, by extension, other classes of drugs that these individuals are taking, we anticipate would be associated with that. So there's clearly some limitations associated with this work. We were limited to variables available in program enrollment and claims files. Any of you that have done work in this area, you know that's a frustration for us, because many of the things that we think generate human behavior are not included in claims databases, and clearly we would need other data to be able to identify those. We also did not observe physician prescription orders. These are claims data, they're not EMR data, and so it's possible that some of the discontinuance was actually physician-generated rather than patient-generated. And last, and certainly not least, this model is deterministic rather than prognostic. In other words, we identified beforehand when people discontinued or not, and then we went back in time. So we had a consistent measure of when people actually stopped using. And what you'd really want to do is to turn this into a prognostic model, which is one of our next steps. So test interactions of dynamic and static factors to see among those who are at higher risk when and who are more likely to discontinue. We think this is a very important area for future research. And then move to prognostic modeling, because that's what's going to be of use to clinicians. And then finally to test the power of such prognostic models and other data sets. And so with that, I'm over. Thank you very much.
So now it'll open up for questions, and if you would use your, as I tell my kids, outside voice, because I don't have mics to pass to you, and if you would just stand and maybe just say who you are and to whom your question is addressed. Please stand. Let me just do a check. You guys are here and okay in the back?
Okay. I mean, from our perspective, I think about the conversation as a spectrum, so that it doesn't really matter where you are on the spectrum, you need to diet and exercise to some extent, right? I mean, so everybody has some recommendations for what their diet should look like and some recommendations for what education they might need around what exercise they need to have. We didn't really turn any of the diabetes patients away. We just referred them to diabetes education, which has its own set of criteria and its own, I mean, if they're diagnosed, then it really is very straightforward to then use that same model to just sort of send them to the other side. The only, for us, limiting step is that they don't necessarily get the exercise piece, which we think would be beneficial. And we've been talking in our health system about how to help patients get some kind of exercise therapy for diabetes, which doesn't really show up in a lot of the medical nutrition models, but it might be beneficial. But truthfully, like if they start with the diet part, the exercise part can come from walking, which you can do anywhere. It doesn't necessarily require a Y and C necessarily to get started.
I think we have to go with the evidence. So let me take a step back. So we've heard this before. So if you travel enough encountering health systems and practices that invariably bring up this question, you wouldn't be the first one using the DDP for newly diagnosed diabetics. So let me give you that reassurance. I think what we're talking about here is an intensive behavioral counseling intervention that is structured and delivered in sequence over time. So that's there. And the underpinning is cognitive behavioral therapy. Unfortunately, from what I see, not many health systems are actually investing this level of resource in diabetes management. I wish they did. If getting the resources to the right patient requires that you use this program other than for the purpose it was created for, that's a decision you and the leaders in your practice have to make yourself. I don't think there's anything to say that there's harm, that all of us will agree. And I can share that people are doing it. They're doing it for patients newly diagnosed with diabetes and whom the recommendation is to emphasize increased physical activity and better nutritional habits. I do want to share that I think in nutrition counseling that is part of this program may not be optimal for somebody with diabetes. So that's where I'm a little worried that the dietary advice in the prevention program is just not optimal. If you can figure out a way around that, perhaps parse patients based on whether they have diabetes or not and make that work for you. And this is the mechanism through which you provide the services your patients with diabetes need. Then I think that's something that's okay. And if your clinic physicians and leadership agree that they're willing to do that, I don't see any harm. But once again, the evidence, all the studies look at individuals with pre-diabetes, so that's what the program is designed for.
I think the only other thing I might add is that there are a lot of behavior change programs that may not be specific for individuals just diabetes, but that community-based organizations can, we have healthy lifestyle programs, we have all different kinds of things that may not be just tailored technical, guidance to your patients, but definitely, part of the power of this kind of thing is that group process, because the same behaviors and have that support is really critical. So I think maybe there's other types of interventions that might apply as well.
Other questions?
Heather,
can you just say who you are?
I'm Janet Williams from the AMA. But and Margo was saying too that I learned something new all the time, even though I'm eating completely as well. But I'm wondering, and I know all my friends are drunk on this, that this dose response, that, when I started working on smoking cessation, the 10-session program, and doctors were coming back, patients were coming back and just saying, too long, whatever it is, right? So is anybody doing research out there that, just because this was the original study, so if anybody really doing research and saying, can we change that dose? Because we know a year is,
yeah. Yeah. It's part of those 28 translations turned into a 12-week, turned into different, and the health affairs meta-analysis that was published kind of shows of all of those where the sort of threshold was. But one of the reasons that CDC took the dosage that they did was because it does yield the greatest correlation in the data to the original research. So yeah, we did, and we hear it. Just because we have good compliance when people come doesn't mean that they don't say, here, you've been here, 16 weeks is too long. But you start to talk and have the conversation going around about the cost of doing nothing or those types of things. And at the end, people don't want the program to be over. I mean, that's the interesting thing too. Once you tip them in that direction, they can keep meeting. We always say we've done our job, people will meet without us, right? You keep those small communities going. But no, there is a lot of work that looks at, trying to figure out the right level of dose to get the same kind of result. And this one's the one that still seems to be the most effective.
And we are after comparing 12 weeks to 16 weeks, but it's a little muddy because also for telehealth care. But for certain subpopulations, so we're trying to speed that out as well, but it's difficult to figure out what's the actual piece of it. But I was
small amounts of weight loss can yield some type of risk reduction. So, like, again, you know, it depends on sort of how you're looking at this, but yeah, even if they're not attending as many sessions, you start to see that risk reduction happening with small amounts of weight loss. So.
There were two outcomes in the study and in some of these sequence studies, which is the attainment of the weight loss target and the increase in physical activity. I would say that from the literature I've seen, if the weight loss target is achieved sooner, you don't, you know, get a whole lot more benefit from continuing because there is an inflection point at 7% weight loss, which was the target in the original study. So I would say if between achieving 7% weight loss and achieving 9 or 10% weight loss, you're not going to get a lot more bang for your buck. And if you can get to 7% in 9 or 8 weeks, I think you'll probably benefit as much as someone who takes 16 weeks to get to that target. The physical activity being held constant, that you commit to continuing the physical activity 115 weeks a week. There are many versions of the program. So the FIN studies are now in their 20th year, and the one in China as well. And then there's actually a European study from Spain. So I think if you look at all the different permutations that are out there, you'll understand that it's not so much about the time you spend in the program, but what you get out of it in terms of the goals.
So I'm going to take the prerogative of the moderator and ask a question. Will you have the benefit of reviewing Medicare claims data in the AMA population to see if you can look at economic outcomes?
It's possible to evaluate Part D, the prescription drug claims data, in our data sets. The problem is that because the MA plans are capitated and are not paid for the services that they deliver directly, there are no A and B claims. And so that makes it difficult to develop a model that contains the kinds of variables that we were interested in using for estimation. So for that purpose, we decided to limit it to the fee-for-service population. I will say this. The fee-for-service population, we know from other work, is actually less healthy than the MA population. Not so much because managed care plans do a better job, but there's risk selection both into managed care plans and more specifically out of managed care plans. So people who develop very serious long-term problems are much more likely to exit their managed care plan and are at least less likely to get in. So there clearly is a risk differential between the two. When we looked at the actual adherence rates, I haven't looked at the discontinuation in the same way that we have for this study. When you look at actual adherence rates, they tend to be fairly comparable across plan types. There's much more variation across the geography, and even within plans, there's variation in adherence across many medications geographically. So there's some really interesting area of research in terms of how, where you are, and who you're treated by influences your use of antidiabetic medicines.
And the Healthcare Innovation Award, that is CMS's assigned
as
a evaluator. So there were 7 evaluators on the first 107 awardees, and we have RTI. So they are doing the claims level analysis and the fee-for-service participants, both on medical claims and then also on some of the pharma analysis.
If you were asking about prevention, the issue of annals that was in the slide that I showed with the review for the Community Preventive Services Task Force had an extensive cost-effectiveness analysis of diabetes prevention as well. It was a very well-done review. There are enough studies out there now that reviews are being done of all the different studies. The AMA and YUSA and the ADA commissioned a paper on a CBO, Congressional Budget Office type evaluation of the savings to Medicare from extending the diabetes prevention program to all beneficiaries, which showed substantial savings over a 10-year time frame of the order of a few million dollars. And the study was done by a consultancy called Avalair Health. And it's accessible online through the websites of all three organizations.
Last call. Join me in thanking our presenters for some very interesting research.